This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Republican Richard Burr has been a United States Senator from North Carolina since 2005. The senior senator. ...62% of the vote. Richard Burr won the Republican primary with 61% of the vote. But he's the incumbent, and unseating the person already in office is always a challenge, but one this former head of the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina believes she's up to. But that's for you to decide. And to that end, Deborah Ross joins us for the hour. Welcome.
I'm so glad to be with you.
Nice to have you here. And in the interest of equal time, I know you'll be sad to hear this, but in the interest of equal time, we will extend an invitation to Senator Burr to join us for a future program.
I'm a great believer in fairness.
Okay. You were in the state legislature for 10 years, and you left to become general counsel for GO Triangle, which is the regional transit agency in that part of the state. It's a difficult task, as I said, to unseat any incumbent, as I'm sure you've been an incumbent, and you know that. And it's difficult for a Democrat in a Republican state. So what made you decide that now is the right time to do this? Because I'm told that the Democratic Party had other people in mind for this position.
Well, the Democratic Party is thrilled that I'm their nominee, and I've been clearly the primary has showed that the Democrats were very excited about this candidacy, and my three opponents have all endorsed the campaign. So we're 100% united in the Democratic Party.
So you're ahead of Hillary Clinton in that achievement.
Well, yes, I am ahead of Hillary Clinton, and I did better than she did in the primary.
Wow.
Because people are really looking for a change, and I am somebody who has been able to not only work within my party, but work across the aisle. But the reason why I decided to run is because the people of North Carolina deserve better representation in Washington, D.C. Nothing is getting done there. The U.S. Senate is on track to work less this year than it's worked in more than 50 years. I've always been a hard worker. I've always stuck up for the working people and for families, and we deserve somebody who will change the dynamic when they get there, work across party lines, and put the people of North Carolina first.
President Obama ran on hope and change, and he thought, or said he thought, that he could make a difference. And it became clear almost from the get-go that that was not going to be happening because the Republicans were going to not cooperate with that desire. How can one person, be they the President of the United States or a United States Senator, change what's going on in Washington right now in this political environment?
Well, I think within a legislative body, it's easier to make that kind of change. So I have experience in our North Carolina General Assembly, and I was elected when we were 50-50 in the State House, so when we had co-speakers of the State House. That was the first 2003 after the 2002 election. I also served when the Democrats were in charge, and I served when the Republicans were in charge. Under all of those scenarios, I got legislation through in a bipartisan way. When more than 90% of the bills that I got passed had a majority of the Republicans who voted for them. And I worked on some hard things, comprehensive domestic violence reform, transit, so that everybody in North Carolina could have access to the same kind of wonderful buses and light rail and all different kinds of modes of transportation that Charlotte really set the example for. I am from the Research Triangle area. I live in Raleigh. When we saw what Charlotte was doing, we took a trip with the Chamber of Commerce. I was committed to get an intermodal transportation bill passed with Representative Becky Carney from this area. I worked with her on it. Ended up carrying that bill And it applies to all the counties, and we did it in a bipartisan way. We had a Republican senator from Wake County sponsoring it. Becky and I did it on the House side, and we got it done. Time and time again, I've been able to show that I can work across the aisle and make positive change.
They say that all politics is local, and as you sit here and you talk about all the things that you were involved in the legislature and all the things that you accomplished in the legislature, it seems that those things are things that really touch the lives of people, as opposed to a lot of the things in Washington that are so far removed that they don't we know they touch us ultimately, but not so much. Light rail touches people, things like that. So why go to Washington? Why not go back to Raleigh? You're in Raleigh. Why not go back to Raleigh in the State House?
Well, I loved my time in the State House. Like you spoke about at the beginning, I left to get a big project done. So the Triangle is working on comprehensive intermodal transportation, and we got a lot done that way. The federal government controls a lot of things that help people every day. And my basic platform from the very beginning, from my launch video 7 months ago, has been economic security for every generation. And I'll lay out what the federal government does that really needs to be beefed up and in some cases changed to provide that kind of economic security for people in North Carolina and across the country. So the first thing for the youngest generation is always education. Mm-hmm. For working people, raising the minimum wage and equal pay for equal work for women. And for our seniors, stabilizing Medicare and Social Security. So for our youngest generation, three really important things for North Carolina. The first is Head Start. My mom was a preschool teacher before North Carolina had our wonderful Governor Jim Hunt and Smart Start. She understood how important Head Start is, particularly in rural areas and in poor urban centers, to make sure kids are ready for school. The federal government funds Head Start. I will go to Washington as a champion for that program. For our rural schools that aren't getting enough money from the legislature and don't have the property tax base that Mecklenburg County has or Wake County has, Title I money goes to those rural schools to make sure that they can have more money for broadband, for teachers, for books, for the things that their local communities can't pay for. And then the federal government is the banker for student loan affordability. And frankly, Congress has failed our students. The average student in North Carolina who goes on to higher education has $25,000 of debt.
Which is under the national average.
It's under the national average, but it's unacceptable.
Okay.
And Richard Burr has voted to cut Pell Grants. He has voted against having an easier way to refinance student loan debt. And it's just dribs and drabs on lowering student loan debt. We need an overall way to lower student loan debt. I worked on those issues at the General Assembly. I represented five colleges and universities, introduced the 529 plan, worked to get lottery money to go to low-income students and expand the eligibility for Pell Grants. These are things that I know how to do and I was able to do across the aisle.
I want to talk a lot about what you want to do and some of the things that you think are wrong with Washington and with what's going on in Washington and with our current senator. But you're from Raleigh, and a lot of people around this neck of the woods don't know anything about Deborah Ross. So tell us a little bit about yourself, about how you were raised, about what got you into politics in the first place.
Sure. I love telling these stories. And it's great because I've talked about these, my background and what motivates me a lot to students and to people who I've mentored, because everybody wants to know how you got to where you are. So my parents have a history of public service. My dad is a doctor. He was a doctor in the Air Force during Vietnam. He was stateside. He was the chief psychiatrist at Strategic Air Command in Nebraska. That's where I went to kindergarten. And that was during Vietnam, before we fully understood the effects that war can have on our servicemen and women and on their families. And he is very proud of his service. I'm proud of his service, and I'm proud of everybody who serves our country. But he has impressed on me how important it is that we take care of military families when somebody is deployed, and how important it is that we take care of people when they come home. Richard Burr has voted against assistance to veterans when they come home with both with health, with education, and with job retraining. I would not do that to people who put themselves on the line for this country. My mom was a preschool teacher. We talked about that a little bit earlier in this program. And she's taught me the value of education, but most importantly, making sure that every child has a good chance when they go to school. Not every child comes from an affluent family or from a community that provides a lot of resources. She worked with disabled kids and integrated them into the preschool environment. She worked with at-risk kids. And I understand how important it is to get kids ready. Now, my mom was the one who gave me a little bit of the political bug. She was very active with the League of Women Voters and worked on getting her friends elected to the school board and to the city council. This was in the 70s when women's rights were a big issue, and there were a lot of stay-at-home moms who worked together to make sure that women had more voices in government. And I think I got my interest in public service from her.
Go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that I participated in student government when I was starting in middle school. And we always did service projects. No matter what we did in student government, we understood that it wasn't just about having a title or having a good resume to go to college, but making sure that we give back to the community.
But, you know, the desire to be helpful and to make things better for people is one thing. But then the reality of politics is that it's rough and tumble and it's dirty and it gets nasty. Why would anybody put themselves through that is a question I ask myself a lot. And then I think the people that do want to put themselves through that, there's something operating there that I don't understand. So why do you want to put yourself through that?
Well, I got out of it because I was sick of it and I wanted to get something done. And that's why I worked on transit in the Triangle, and I believe successfully.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a different year. People really do want that change. I feel it. We all feel it, but I see it and I hear it as I travel all over the state of North Carolina. And I am inspired by Jim Hunt. I'm inspired by Terry Sanford. I'm inspired by the civil rights leaders here in Charlotte, Julius Chambers, who was a mentor to me, and Jim Ferguson, who I worked with doing civil rights work in the 90s. We need more people who are willing to step up to the plate in a selfless way and give North Carolina the representation that it deserves and that it's had in the past that's made us proud.
You, as I said in the beginning, won the Democratic primary with 62% of the vote. Your opponent came away. He also had three challengers, as did you, with 61% of the vote. Does that leave you evenly matched in this race in 30 seconds or less, or are we talking about apples and oranges here?
Well, I think what it shows is that we both have strong support in our base. I can tell you that all of my opponents are for me in this, in going forward. I don't know that about Senator Burr. You'll have to ask him. But we're both starting out with a base. And then the question is, what are the voters who don't vote in Democratic primaries thinking? And as I'm traveling around the state, they are thinking that they need a change. They need somebody who will stick up for them and care about their everyday lives.
Deborah Ross is our guest today. She is the Democratic candidate in the race for United States Senator in the election in November. And when we come back, there are a thousand things we'll talk about or try to talk about in the next several minutes. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Nexen Pruitt, over 190 lawyers helping companies meet business challenges in court and at the deal table. From Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations, next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. Support also comes from Charlotte-Mecklenburg Stormwater Services, an agency that helps protect and restore local streams and lakes. Everyone can help prevent water pollution. Details at stormwater.charmec.org. Opioid-related deaths have soared throughout the U.S. since the early 2000s, and North Carolina is no exception. As heroin overdoses have spiked, so have cases of hepatitis C. Some North Carolina senators now want to address that by legalizing a syringe exchange program. It's one example of how lawmakers are getting creative in dealing with the epidemic. And tomorrow morning at 9, guest host Michael Tomczyk will explore that and other proposals at the General Assembly. That's when Charlotte Talks, Wednesday morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Hillary Clinton is under pressure after a State Department report criticized her use of a private email server. What's in the report, potential security risks, and whether it could affect Secretary Clinton's bid for the White House.
The Diane Rehm Show, following Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Deborah Ross, former state legislator and now running for United States Senate as the Democrat in the race against the incumbent Richard Burr, the Republican. Shortly after your win in March, the North Carolina Republican Party was very quick to label you as too liberal for North Carolina. And when you announced your candidacy, the director of the North Carolina GOP, Dallas Woodhouse, said that you were not just to the far left of the people of North Carolina. She is to the far left of her own caucus in the General Assembly. I suppose that's not terribly surprising to you, but how would you respond to that? Are you too liberal?
Well, I'm not a big fan of labels. My values are North Carolina's values. And as we just discussed, 62% of the Democrats voted for me, and all of my opponents are supporting this campaign. So I'm clearly within the mainstream of my party. And the bottom line is this. People want somebody who's going to work for them every day. I got the legislation that I got passed, 90% of it had majority Republican support. That doesn't sound too left to me.
You know, for the longest time, Democrats have run from the word liberal. They have chosen not to embrace it. They even have chosen to embrace the word progressive, which had different connotations years ago. What we're seeing in this presidential race is incredibly interesting because you have the person who was everybody thought was going to be the automatic winner in the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton, struggling. She's got the numbers, but she's struggling to win the hearts and minds of a lot of people. And Bernie Sanders is a liberal. He's a socialist. And he is attracting a lot of people. So maybe it's time to embrace that big L word.
Well, what I would say is that a lot of the folks who supported Bernie clearly are supporting our campaign because I hear from them, I see them wherever I go, and I'm thrilled to have the broad support of my party.
When did it become a dirty word, and why should it be a dirty word? Why should liberal be a bad word?
I don't think that the word liberal is a bad word. I just think it has become a label. And when we talk about labels, then we're really not talking about serving the people. And so, of course, the Republican Party would throw those words out. What I like to say in response to that is, well, I'll be the most liberal since Terry Sanford, because he challenged the racial divides and he appointed more women to positions within his administration than anybody else. So if they want to, they can call me whatever they want. What I want to do is serve the people. And they're name callers from way back. We've seen it, and it's just politics as usual. Let's talk about getting something done.
Prior to your service in the legislature, you were the former head of the North Carolina ACLU, which many people have compared to the liberal version of the NRA. They have the same kind of power
That's
on the
cute.
Left that the NRA has on the right. So does that automatically make you the big, big, big L liberal?
Well, the Civil Liberties Union is dedicated to the Constitution. And so the Civil Liberties Union has represented people on the left and on the right.
So
I myself did that. I represented a Republican who was saying he was, they were trying to chill his speech in an election. And he ended up becoming a really good friend of mine and ended up on the Board of Governors. Hmm. So I, you know, the thing about the Constitution that is really beautiful and people forget is that it applies to everybody, regardless of your political background.
So when you were there, what kinds of things were you advocating for at the ACLU?
Oh, well, let me give you three examples of the things that I think were the most important that we got done. The first thing is that when I was there, we advocated for an anti-racial profiling bill that collected statistics from the Highway Patrol and law enforcement on traffic stops. And we got that passed in a bipartisan way. And it is now the model for the country. The Greensboro Police Department is using it. The Durham Police Department is using it. Originally, people thought that only the lawyers would use it to defend people. But it's now being used for training and analysis purposes, and it is a model. We got insurance to cover contraception before the Affordable Care Act. That also was done in a bipartisan way. We got a little lucky on that one. A Republican doctor from Gaston County was interested in doing it, and that was when we found out that insurance was covering Viagra. And once we found that out, there was a bipartisan group of people, particularly the women. We got Republican and Democratic women very, very interested in making sure that insurance covers contraception. And another thing that I'd just like to highlight, especially in light of what former Chief Justice I. Beverly Lake has come out with his views on the death penalty, we got a DNA innocence law passed in North Carolina. It was because a couple of criminal cases had come up where old DNA showed that somebody was innocent. One was the Ronald Cotton case. Mm-hmm. Bipartisan. We passed a DNA innocence law that allowed people to test DNA even after they had been convicted. And that has gotten people off of death row and out of prison who were really innocent, and made law enforcement have to go try to find the bad guy. Those are three huge things that the Civil Liberties Union and I contributed to the state of North Carolina.
Some people call North Carolina a red state. Others say it's a purple state. And, of course, Mecklenburg County is the bastion of Democratic politics, but the rest of the state is Republican, or so it seems. And we recently did a couple of roundtable discussions with listeners, voters. We did a roundtable with Republican and conservatives, and then we did a roundtable with more liberal people and Democrats. And one thing leapt out of those conversations, and that these people see the world in very different ways. How would you describe your worldview?
Well, I try to understand where people are coming from and make sure that we can have a positive outcome. So my husband's an engineer, so he always analyzes everything and sees the flaws or the risks or the negativity. I try to look at a situation and see how we can have a positive outcome. So even if I don't get 100% of what I want, how can we move something forward? How can I reach out to somebody who might be different than me and figure out where we have common ground? I've done that. I've done that in the legislature. I've done that as an attorney. It's kind of interesting to me. When you're an attorney and you're involved in lawsuits and negotiations, you know, there's usually somebody on the other side.
Yeah.
So many of the attorneys who are on the opposite side of a legal matter for me are supporting my campaign. And I think it's because we understand that there's always going to be a tension. A lot of people are afraid of conflict. I'm not afraid of conflict. You need to have the conflict to be able to resolve things and move things forward. The key is to be civil and to be respectful when you have conflict. So that's a lot about how I see the world and how I see making change.
We started this conversation by you saying, and my saying about your acceptance speech on the night of your winning the primary, that you think that we need better representation in Washington. And I'm curious as to what that means, because a lot of people today vote for people they think who are going to rigidly support the reasons they voted for them, and that any movement from that rigidity is almost a sign of treason. Mm-hmm. Compromise has become as bad a word as liberal. So how can you be? How can you better represent people? How do you do that in that environment?
So I think that the legislative process is entirely a process of compromise. Extremes will never fully win the day. And it's about relationships. And so I represented in Raleigh, I represented a very diverse district. I represented downtown Raleigh and old Raleigh, kind of like the Myers Park area here in Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I represented southeast Raleigh, which is predominantly African American. And I represented a small town in Garner. And what I did was once a month or once every 6 weeks, I would bring people from those different communities to sit down and have a Dutch treat breakfast and talk about issues and talk to each other. Some of them had never talked to somebody from just even 3 or 4 miles down the way.
Yeah.
And I find that when you bring people together in an atmosphere where you're solving problems and you're talking about your community, you can bridge some of those divides. On the very extremes, you're never going to be able to do it. But I do believe that 80% of people, and that's just a rough number, but 80% of people, if they listen to each other, if they try to work together, can come up with a solution to some of our problems.
So you would be willing to reach across the aisle, as you did in the State House, and compromise.
Always.
And do some horse trading.
Absolutely.
So in this environment where that is considered to be a betrayal, why are you not betraying the people who believe in you and your candidacy and who will vote for you in November by being willing to go with the Republicans on some things?
I don't believe any of this is a betrayal. I actually believe it's doing your job. A perfect example. Richard Burr won't even meet with President Obama's Supreme Court nominee and won't even meet with the most recent appointee to the Eastern District of North Carolina, which has been missing a judge for 10 years. It is the constitutional duty of a senator to give advice and consent on judicial nominees. The constitutional duty. So if we have a Republican president, which I hope we do not have, it would be my duty to have a hearing. If I don't think that person's qualified, then I'll vote them down. I'll ask them hard questions. But to refuse to even meet with somebody is to violate your oath of office and to not care about our system of justice, our system of government, and our people.
But you're vying for a place in that environment. And unless the Senate changes hands and is given over to the Democrats, that's the reality.
As it will be.
Okay, but that's the reality that you'll be facing,
right,
if that does not turn out to be the reality. How does a Democratic senator work in that world?
Oh, I think it can be done, and I did it when Tom Tillis was the Speaker of the House. I got several bills passed when he was the Speaker of the House. I work on things that have some kind of consensus support. I'll tell you some of the examples that I worked on when I was in the minority and got passed. We found out – this was a fun bill. We found out that we have lots of chocolate makers in North Carolina, you know, these small artisanal chocolate makers.
Right.
But our ABC laws prohibited them from putting any alcohol in the chocolate. This is, you know, big government regulation hurting small businesses.
So much for cherry cordials.
So much for cherry cordials. Yeah. So I worked to get a bill passed that allows chocolate makers to be able to put a certain trace amounts of alcohol, and as long as it's labeled. And Tom Tillis was tremendously supportive of this bill. I actually think he had somebody in his district who benefited and wrote me a little note congratulating me on the bill. So I know it's not a big thing, but it helped some small businesses. It was a fun bill to work on. I also worked on a bill promoting mediation centers, and that got bipartisan support, and only Democrats had supported that, you know, had sponsored that bill. So there were several examples of things that I've gotten through in a Republican legislature. And I think this is one of those areas. I know people don't always love lawyers, but it's one of those areas where being a lawyer has been very helpful, because I've forged a lot of good relationships with Republican lawyers. We'll agree on a problem that needs to be fixed. And we know how, just like in the courthouse, how to disagree about things, but to be cordial about it.
Let's talk about economic security. There are a lot of angry people and frustrated people and scared people in the country right now, and they're responding. We know that because they're responding to Donald Trump, and they're responding to Bernie Sanders, who's speaking in a different language and in a different way, but he's speaking to people who have economic concerns. You talk about the need to raise the minimum wage, to make college more affordable, to ensure equal pay for women, and finding ways to stabilize Medicare and Social Security. Which of the presidential candidates do you think would be most helpful to you in that effort?
Well, I think certainly the Democratic presidential candidates have staked themselves out on raising the minimum wage. And so what we need to do is flip Congress so that that issue gets taken up. This week is the 9th anniversary of the last time that the minimum wage was raised. 9 years.
And Republicans say raising the minimum wage puts a burden on business and will ultimately be detrimental to the economy. Why is that not true?
Because Republicans see this as a zero-sum game rather than growing the economy. We need to raise the minimum wage incrementally. We can't just double it overnight. We need to do it incrementally, and then we have to index it to inflation or – yes, and there are proposals to do that.
What about indexing it to where you live? Because it costs a heck of a lot more to live in New York City than it does in
– there are some proposals to do that too. Unfortunately, our North Carolina legislature has said that, no, we can't do that at a local level anymore, which is just a horrible thing in North Carolina, where we have rural communities where the current minimum wage, of course, should go up, but it doesn't need to double overnight. And then urban communities where people barely can get by working two or three minimum wage jobs. But there are some great proposals in Congress to raise the minimum wage incrementally and then do an index. And then, of course, we should let our municipalities, where the cost of living is higher, be able to have a higher minimum wage. But this is the fallacy in what the Republicans are talking about. People who earn the minimum wage or even slightly more spend all of their money. They spend all of their money buying food and buying clothing and paying for housing. All of those businesses will benefit from people who get higher salaries.
But won't it raise the cost of things that those very same people will have to buy? Won't it raise the price of things at Walmart, raise the price of things at McDonald's, et cetera?
It may raise the price of some things. But what it will also do is lower the subsidies that government has to give to low-income people, because we'll have fewer low-income people. And when government doesn't have to pay for those entitlement programs, government can lower taxes.
Speaking of
it's not a zero-sum game on the businesses.
Speaking of entitlement programs, and we only have a minute left here in this segment, but in speaking of that, Medicare and Social Security, you say that Richard Burr has voted to end those programs as we know them, and you want to stabilize and keep them solvent. We may have to go into the next segment for this, but start on how you would do that.
So, of course, we need to look at what funds go into Social Security and Medicare. And Richard Burr voted to cut them both, and he wants to privatize Medicare, which would then take government money out of it and give it to the private sector. Not a good idea. So what we need to look at is how to get more money to come into those programs, how we need to keep pace with inflation, and how we work today. Some people retire earlier, some people retire later. And some people are making higher amounts of money, and we could raise a little bit the cap on the contributions.
Deborah Ross, our guest. She is the Democratic candidate for United States Senate. We'll come right back with more in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Honda of Concord, committed to customer service, satisfaction, and bringing excellence to the car buying experience. Offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles, details at hondaofconcord.com. Support also comes from the Original Mattress Company, providing mattresses and bedding hand-built at the Charlotte factory and offered direct to the consumer. More information at originalmattress.com. Democratic presidential frontrunner Hillary Clinton is under pressure following a State Department report which criticized her use of a private email server while she was Secretary of State. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, they'll look at what's in that Inspector General report, as well as the potential security risks and whether this will affect Clinton's bid for the White House this year. That's coming up at the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock here on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Melissa Block. You know, your favorite NPR news programs are on the air every day thanks to you. And believe it or not, your car. When you donate your old car to this station, we'll turn your Nissan into our newscasts, your Ford into our far-flung foreign reports, your Buick into our book reviews. So when the time comes, remember, instead of trading your car in, you can turn it into the programs you love.
Stop by WFAE.org and click on the support tab for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is former state legislator and now U.S. Senate candidate for the Democratic Party in North Carolina, Deborah Ross. We were talking about Social Security and Medicare a minute ago. Social Security is the so-called third rail of American politics. Would a junior senator from North Carolina have the clout to take on that third rail and make changes to stabilize the system?
So the junior senator from North Carolina never shies away from a tough problem. Always will roll up her sleeves. Of course I can't do anything by myself. Everything is better with a team. But I'm committed to doing it. And I did it in the General Assembly. Every time there was a tough problem, they would say, give it to Deborah. She'll work with other people and figure it out. And frequently we could come to those solutions. I did it a lot with Dan Clodfelter, one of your great state senators. So just the fact that I want to work on it, that I'm gathering information, and that I'm willing to work across the aisle, I think goes a lot farther than what we've got in Congress right now.
How do you explain that most Americans like Social Security, most Americans like Medicare and Medicaid?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They don't like the Affordable Care Act. They don't like the idea of universal health care at all. How do you explain that?
Well, most Americans get their insurance through work, so they don't have to buy their own insurance. So the people who the Affordable Care Act helps are people with pre-existing conditions, women who have had to pay more for their health care than men did because now we've taken out that discrimination. Young people like my staff, who we provide health care for, but before would just go without health care. Now they can stay on their parents' plans until they're 26. So there's a whole group of people who have been shut out of the health care market. And so a lot of people don't have to worry about buying insurance. But the Affordable Care Act has helped all those groups of people that I've talked about. It needs to be improved. But it has certainly helped a lot of people.
Well, that was my next question, because Republicans hate the Affordable Care Act, or at least they say they do publicly, and they have tried to repeal it. And if they take the White House and keep the Congress, they will repeal it. What would you do to fix – what's wrong with it, and what would you do to fix it?
Well, one of the big problems is that Medicaid expansion is not being done universally around the country.
That's the problem in North Carolina.
It's an enormous problem in North Carolina. If the legislature would vote to expand Medicaid, three things would happen. The price of insurance would come down because we would have a larger pool of people who would be insured. Our rural hospitals would not be struggling as much as they do with uncompensated care. So what uncompensated care is – people who cannot afford care go and get the services and then they can't pay for it. And so that's on the books of the hospitals. And if we had more people with health insurance, for a healthier North Carolina and increase health care jobs. So,
but the governor has told me on this program that the state can't afford to increase the Medicare program. First of all, it was a mess in North Carolina. I don't know what that means, but that's what he said. And he said, we don't know what it's going to cost because the federal government is subsidizing the expansion for the first several years, and then it's on the states, or much of it is on the states. How would you fix that?
Well, what I would say is, let's get people health care now and get them healthy so it's cheaper to insure them later. One of the reasons why there's been an expansion in healthcare costs under the Affordable Care Act, though the Affordable Care Act has kept them down relative to what would have happened without it, is that people are getting insurance for the first time in their lives. So they're getting insurance and they have pre-existing conditions. And so of course they're going to the doctor and of course that's costing money. But over time, as people stabilize their health, as they engage in preventative health care, the cost of insurance and the cost of medicine goes down.
How do you feel
We're
about
paying for the big chunk now.
How do you feel about universal health care? Eliminating the insurance companies, make it a program like Medicare.
It would be wonderful if we could make sure that every single person has health care in a quality way, but we have to get there step by step. Mm-hmm. You can't just snap your fingers and solve every problem. I have learned that as a legislator. I've learned it as an attorney. So let's take the good parts of the Affordable Care Act, fix the parts that aren't working as well, make sure the maximum number of people can be insured and stabilize their health, and then work on preventative medicine. It's the only way to go. Every doctor would tell you that.
We have a major problem in this country, and you can see it in the anger and the frustration and the fear of people as they approach this election, with the vanishing middle class, which includes the vanishing of jobs that have been outsourced to other parts of the world because we have to keep prices down, the fact that corporations are hoarding cash like there's no tomorrow, and they're not re-increased. The wages have stagnated for years and years and years. And unions have lost their pull to represent people, and therefore a lot of people are just making it day by day, and their children are not having a better experience than they did, which has been the folklore American thing that your life will be better than your parents' life. How do you fix that in this world that where globalization is part of the reality of life today?
Well, I don't think we can fix everything, but government has a role to play. So it is becoming clearer and clearer that in order to have a job that pays a good wage, this generation is going to need higher education and world-class skills.
And how do you pay for that? Because the cost of education is going up. The cost of student debt is becoming unaffordable for most people. And kids are leaving school, as you said, with $25,000 in North Carolina, $37,000 across the country. It's $1.25 trillion in cumulative debt just for student loans. How do you get all that under control?
Well, certainly the people who have high interest student loans should be able to refinance them at today's low rates, particularly if they have a job. If we can refinance our houses and we can refinance other things, we should be able to have a good program that allows for that refinancing.
Should the government be making a profit off of student loans?
This government should not be making a profit off of student loans. It's absolutely ridiculous that we are penalizing our students for getting the education that they need to compete in a global economy. We also need to retrain our workers. North Carolina has a model community college system for doing that. But Congress needs to play a role in that too, in worker retraining programs. Richard Burr has voted against worker retraining programs. And we need to make sure women get paid equal pay for equal work. There are more women who are heads of households and whose income is determinative as to whether or not people can buy groceries, whether they can pay for their kids' medicine. There are ways that the government can help. But one thing that might really turn a lot of things around in terms of job creation that the government is in charge of is infrastructure investment. We have crumbling infrastructure, so it's a safety issue. But we also have low interest rates. So if there's any time to issue debt, it should be in a low interest rate environment, and these are jobs you can't outsource.
Why are we reluctant to do that? Because President Eisenhower called for the construction of the interstate highway system, and he was a Republican. Why could we do it in the 50s, in the 40s, in the 30s during the Great Depression, and we can't do it today? Why?
I really don't understand. We got a lot done in the General Assembly, and a lot of those bills were bipartisan. The bond issue that we're dealing with right now that just passed was passed in a bipartisan way. So I want to work on that issue. I was a municipal bond lawyer working on water and sewer systems and other kinds of infrastructure around the state. I've worked on transit and transportation issues. And infrastructure is a huge, huge priority. And happy to roll up my sleeves and get down to work when I'm your next U.S. senator.
One of the big problems that the world faces today, or one of the big problems we're being told we face today, is national security and our participation in Middle Eastern conflicts and ISIS. And your opponent is likely to stress national security because he is the chair of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Has he brought that up in this race, and how have you responded?
Well, my response is that there's a difference between experience and judgment. And my opponent has also voted to shut down the Department of Homeland Security over a budget fight and voted to let people on the terrorist watch list be able to keep their guns and buy guns. And now he's supporting Donald Trump, who has no foreign policy experience or ability to deal, you know, known ability to deal with ISIS. So I question that judgment. I have a degree in international relations. I've worked with foreign business leaders and lawyers and judges. It's a complicated, dangerous world. We have to keep Americans safe, but we need to do it with good judgment and with our allies.
As I mentioned, we had a group of Republican voters on this program very recently who spoke about the government's crippling business and crippling entrepreneurs with too many regulations and corporate taxes that were far too high. What would you say to them?
Well, I gave you a perfect example earlier about a small business that was running up against the ABC laws when we couldn't put any liquor in chocolate. So we need to look at regulations and see which ones are necessary and which ones aren't. We must keep our people safe, and we need to have, you know, make sure that we have clean air and clean water and not pollute our environment. But we also need to make sure that our businesses thrive. And a lot of that has to do with access to credit, being able to keep costs down. And we're seeing some entrepreneurs come up all over the state doing wonderful, wonderful things, and we need to support them.
How do you see the top of the ticket affecting you, and both tickets affecting your race?
Well, it's been a wild ride. That's what I can say. I've primarily been paying attention to my race because I think that I'm much more in touch with what's going on the ground here in North Carolina and North Carolina values. There's a lot of conjecture about what's going on. What I hope is that the presidential race stops being this kind of circus, reality TV show, all the things that people are talking about, and we start to focus on the issues that everyday North Carolinians care about. That's what I'm doing in this campaign. That's what I'll bring to Washington.
You're a woman. Why do so many women not trust Hillary Clinton? Why do they see something in Hillary Clinton that makes them uneasy? And not just women, men too, but women.
That's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that question. She spent her career working for women and children and breaking glass ceilings and working for international recognition for women's rights.
Earlier this month, The Washington Post reported that you plan to make House Bill 2 a major issue in this campaign, and there doesn't seem to be much middle ground on this issue. So if you campaign against it, you're going to offend a whole bunch of people, and if you campaign for it, you're going to offend a whole bunch of people. It's a Sophie's choice.
Well, House Bill 2 is horrible legislation that discriminates, has created federal lawsuits, and has impacted the economy of this state and the reputation of this state so negatively, I can't think of the last thing that hit North Carolina this hard. So it's untenable to support it. It also prohibits local governments from having a higher minimum wage. It prohibits people from filing age discrimination and religious discrimination lawsuits in our state courts and makes them go to the federal court. It's a whole hodgepodge of bad policy for North Carolina. And I've been traveling this state. In Wilmington, that's just starting to attract the film and the TV industry back after the tax credits had been turned into a grant program. Now, the entertainment community will not go to Wilmington, and that's costing people's jobs. All the hotel industry is losing jobs when these concerts are being canceled. Right. High Point Furniture Market had people deciding that they weren't going to come this year, and if we don't get rid of House Bill 2, they're not going to come in years to come.
You talked early in this program about being willing to compromise and demonstrated that willingness in the General Assembly when you were there. The Charlotte City Council opted on Monday night or last Monday night not to repeal the ordinance. They were urged to repeal the ordinance so some movement could take place in Raleigh with HB2. Should they repeal this ordinance?
Not until they know that people's rights are going to be taken care of and the other parts of the bill are going to be taken care of. So Raleigh didn't offer up what it was going to do. And so part of compromise, I've negotiated a lot of deals, a lot of business deals, and a lot of legislation. People put their full cards on the table, and then you figure out what can give and what can't give. I didn't see that Raleigh came up with any of those cards on the table and said what they were going to do. And so first rule of negotiation is, don't do everything the other side wants before you know what you're going to get.
The latest public policy poll found on the North Carolina Senate race dates from April 27th and shows Richard Burr leading you by only 4 points, 40-36, which is a slight gain for you from what the poll showed in March. And you're slightly ahead of him with independents, and yet you're largely unknown among voters, with 65% saying they have no opinion of you. So what are you doing to make inroads with those people, because those are the people who would get you elected?
Well, I'm coming on your show, and I'm crisscrossing the state of North Carolina talking to voters. And everywhere we go, we get great, great reception. And I've really enjoyed speaking with you today. You've asked fantastic questions, exactly what the voters need to know about. And so we're out and about.
Richard Burr, last report, had a $5.31 million war chest, and I think you had $292,000. That was back in March. That was according to the News and Observer in Raleigh. Can you beat him when he has so much money at his disposal?
Well, I outraised him last quarter, plan to do it again. And there are a lot of people who win with less funds. The key is having the right message.
Deborah Ross, the Democratic candidate for United States Senator running against Richard Burr, the incumbent Republican, this November. Thank you so much for the hour.
It's been my pleasure.